You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Can only come from you. Ghetto people, yeah.
What are you gonna
You are listening to African Perspectives, where we view the issues of our day from an African worldview and African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak, having been granted permission. To our ancestors, whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders, whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters, in the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet. It gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is truly an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. Everything that on the planet that lives, it needs water, from a tiny microscopic organism to a tall redwood tree. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe, which simply means so be it. So we pour this libation to God, for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say, Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity. Everyone who has lived, everyone who will live in the future, we all have a common ancestral root in Africa. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet in the opening. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were others as well, as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe. Civilizations that were flourishing and growing while Europe was in a medieval or dark age. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu, an outstanding educational institution. So we pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say, Ashe. We pour this libation to the Maafa, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the Infakani, the great tragedy, uprooted out of Africa. Our brothers and sisters lay a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. We're in North America, South America, Central America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to our brothers and sisters who suffered the Maafa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the great tragedy. We pour this libation in their honor and in their memory. We do not know their names, but because of them and their sacrifice, we are here. So we say, Ashe. We pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you will know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a captive want to do? Get free. So we pour this libation to all those men and women who fought against enslavement. In fact, I maintain that some of us are more of a slave today than we were in our initial captivity, because some of us are a slave to vice, to corruption, to drugs, sex, and violence. So we pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement, Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Dingmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman. We always resisted, and we will always resist. So we pour this libation in the name and the honor of those men and women who fought against our captivity. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We sashay. We pour this libation to brotherhood and sisterhood, together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good family life. There's a saying, conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is not good. Because why? We lack consciousness. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are historically, who you are culturally. So once we begin to understand the importance of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. Brothers and sisters, let us all say, Ashe, Ashe.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at Time for an Awakening.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com, and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Brother Oshi, Hotep family. Hope everything is well with you today. Hope everything is going the way that you want it to go. And hope you get a chance to do all the things you want to do, must do, could do, will do, and should do. And I hope the weather will be accommodating for you to do it. But if it's not, I know you'll get it done anyway, because that's the kind of brother and sister that you is, and we appreciate you for it. This is African Perspectives. We're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 10 to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Mountain, 8 to 10 Pacific, or any other time around the world. But if you cannot listen to this program live, you can always go to our archives at timeforanawakening.com. Look for podcasts, click on that. And right once you click on that, there will be African Perspectives. Click on that, and then the programs will be right there that are dated and titled. Other programming that we have here on Time for an Awakening Media. Once again, this program is every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And right after this program on Monday is Acres of Diamonds from 6 to 8, Public Affairs Programming out of Philadelphia with Brother Wahad. And then following that is Let's Buy Black 365 from 8 to 9. Then right after that is Conversation Reparations with Brother Jamoke and Sister Lacey from 9 to 10. On Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10. And then on Wednesday, Revive with Sister POC, Proof of Consciousness, Revive. And then on Thursdays, Relationships with Joy and Troy at 7 p.m. Relationships with Joy and Troy at 7 p.m. If it's Friday and it's 8 p.m. Eastern, that's right, brothers and sisters, it's time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And then on Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., it's not me. It's our good sister, Sister POC, her program Revive, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And then Sunday evening at 7 p.m., it's time for an awakening once again with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Every Monday through Friday at 10 p.m. Eastern to 12 a.m., the Warm Valentine Show right here on Time for an Awakening Media. And the number to call is 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. We Buy Black. WeBuyBlack.com, the largest online marketplace for American African-owned businesses, is WeBuyBlack.com. You can get everything you need from American African-owned businesses from WeBuyBlack.com. So go online and check out the products that they have that are produced by us, WeBuyBlack.com. Africa for the Africans, Brother Bomani Tayembe, please go to his website, AfricaForTheAfricans.org, and check out the trips that he's planning. Also, too, give him a call, 404-931-9429, 404-931-9429. Trip upcoming next month, April 3rd, coming up soon, April 3rd through the 13th. And going to Senegal and Gambia for $3,300. Not bad, really. Then going to Ghana, his twice-a-year repatriation and investment tour. May 25th to June 5th, $3,700. And then in November, November 20th through November 30th, South Africa Roots and Culture Tour for $3,700. And then finishing up the year, December 24th through January 5th, 2021, the Ghana and Repatriation Tour, $3,700. Beginning next year, April 3rd through April 12th, April 3rd to April 12th, 2021, is the Senegal and Gambia Roots Tour, and that's going to be $3,500, a couple hundred dollars more. But listen, brothers and sisters, it is well worth it. Put a deposit down of $400, pay on it as you consistently can until it's full paid, and then there you go. A trip of a lifetime, brothers and sisters. Believe me, it is. And he goes first class. Go online. Look at the photos, Brother Bomani, and the people he've taken. Go to facebook.com/Bomani. If you want to see videos, go to youtube.com/Bomani2007. Dr. Rinoco Rashidi, my good brother, Dr. Rinoco. Brother Rinoco, he's going to, he has a tour coming later on this year, October 5th through the 16th, going to Uganda and Rwanda. Two beautiful places. You ought to see the photos that he has. Go to his website, Dr. Rinoco, DRRUNOKO.com, Dr. Rinoco. He also has a trip for South Africa planned as well. No, I'm sorry, excuse me. He has a trip to Kemet, Egypt, that same month, October 22nd through November 4th. He's going to Kemet. And you should see these photos. Fantastic. You know, the cruise down the Nile, you know, Abu Simbel. You can't go to Kemet unless you go to Abu Simbel. Got to go to Abu Simbel. And into Queen Hatshepsut's temple in the Valley of the Kings and Queens. All of these beautiful photos, all these places that he's going to take you. So, and that trip is $4,200, and the other trip to is about $4,100. So, brothers and sisters, these are trips of a lifetime. All it takes is for you to make the down payment and plan to make it happen. Habesha, Habesha Incorporated. Habesha stands for Helping Africa by Establishing Schools at Home and Abroad. Educational component, but more importantly and even deeply, it is a process. It is a project. They are doing the work. They are constructing, they have been constructing Kashi, which stands for, you know, that is the brother who was a botanist. And Dr. Kashi, Dr. Adu, Dr. Kwaku Adu, Adore, excuse me. And so it stands for establishing and sustainability. This is a beautiful program, brothers. This, I mean, what they are doing, they're doing the work. Kashi Works, Black to Your Roots, Sustainable Steeds, Golden Growers, all of these things. It's so fantastic. And like I said, when you see the work that they're doing, you know, because Habesha is a Pan-African organization that cultivates leadership in youth and families through practical experiences in cultural education, sustainable agriculture, entrepreneurship, holistic health, and technology. They are doing the work. They are building. You see, you know, when you go online to their website and you see what they, what they're planning. Yes, that's the plan, but they also still also show you the buildings that are going up. It is happening in Ghana, West Africa. It is happening. In fact, their grand opening is planned for this year in October. And I hope it comes to fruition. Brothers and sisters, support Kashi. Shrine of the Black Madonna. Shrine of the Black Madonna, located here in the West End here in Atlanta. I'm Ralph David Abernathy. The Shrine of the Black Madonna, their hours are Wednesday through Saturday from 12 to 7 and Sunday from 1 to 3. On Saturday, they have a educational program of Know Thyself.
African History Project, African History Program, every Saturday, free and open to the public, 1:30 to 3:30. Free and open to the public, 1:30 to 3:30 at the Shrine of the Black Madonna. Also, too, if you can't make that, but you would love to get that information, they have a history multimedia library, the African History Club of the Multimedia Library, which is now 7 terabytes of African enlightenment. Also, too, they have an African Holocaust Museum. They got furniture. They got clothing. They got the red, black, and green Nagash shoes. They got it all at the Shrine of the Black Madonna. And the number to call is 404-549-8676, 404-549-8676, right there in the West End on Ralph David Abernathy here in Atlanta. At the Greenbrier Mall, the Medu Bookstore at the Greenbrier Mall opened Monday through Saturday from 10 to 9, and then Sunday from 12 to 6. The sisters got all good things at the Medu Bookstore. Every book, if they don't have the book that you're looking for, believe me, they'll get it for you. That's Mama Nia, and she does a great job. And her number is 404-346-3263, 404-346-3263 at the Greenbrier Mall. I will be doing my history program at the Greenbrier Mall at the Medu Bookstore on April 27, Wednesday, April 22nd. Wednesday, April 22nd from 6:30 to 8:30. Hope that you can make it out there. The Black Dot Cultural Center and Bookstore with Brother Kazimde Ajamu, right there in Lithonia. The number to call is 404-519-8107, 404-519-8107. There is light in the Black Dot. Unfortunate information. Listened to the program last night, the Ulu Thursday night broadcast with Brother Thurman and Brother Kambizi, outstanding program, good information. Unfortunately, our weekend conference has been canceled. It was on the campus of the Atlanta University System, Morris Brown, at the Theological Institute. It has been canceled. Man, the Us Lifting Us conference this weekend has been canceled, like a lot of other things have been canceled. It would have been too late to try to scramble to find another location. So, man. So, that's Us Lifting Us every Thursday night. That Thursday night broadcast is 929-477-2789. 9 p.m. from 9 p.m. to 10. 929-477-2789. And I know when Baba Akima was on Wednesday, had some of my good brother callers, and it was no offense, believe me, and he took none either, about still being on Blog Talk Radio. But eventually he's going to make that move, like another brother, brother who has disaster awareness for community preparedness, which is also on Blog Talk Radio still. I talked to Brother Yusuf Muhammad, and that is today, every Friday from 4 to 6 p.m., from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time is Disaster Awareness for Community Preparedness. And the number to call is 563-999-3089, 563-999-3089. Akabin Institute. Baba Baruti and Sister Yabaruti, once again, are doing an outstanding job of educating our young warriors, which we so desperately need. We need educated minds, independent minds, minds that think sovereignty, think independently, think liberation, and are willing to fight for it. Akabin Institute, located here in Atlanta. Make your check or money order out to Akabin Institute, P.O. Box 10786, Atlanta, Georgia 30310. That is Akabin Institute, P.O. Box 10786, Atlanta, Georgia 30310. If you have PayPal and Cash App, put the dollar sign and then YAA, the letter M, and then Baruti, BARUTI, to make your donations and make them consistently if you can. Another organization that we support here at African Perspectives is Sister Gabrielle Aurelia and her organization, Sanjay Aidi. She is doing outstanding work in the rural area, in the northeastern area of the island of Haiti, and is doing outstanding work. And she definitely deserves to be supported. Sanjay Aidi. SONJE-AYITI.org. Sanjay Aidi. Go look at what they're doing. The education, the health care, the growing of food, and the chicken farms, and all these things to make themselves self-sufficient. And that's what it's all about. You and I both know that, right? That's what it's all about. Make yourself self-sufficient. And many times they struggle with that. And so they need to be supported. And that's what we should do. We should support them in that effort. The Enye Sasim of Daily Revolutionary Thought. The Enye Sasim of Daily Revolutionary Thought. March 12th. The basic difference between a socialist society and a capitalist society does not lie in their methods of producing wealth, but in the way that wealth is distributed. Julius Nyerere. Pan-African nationalist socialism is the only political philosophy that can bring us safely back home. I repeat. Pan-Africanism. A Pan-African nationalist socialism is the only political philosophy that can bring us safely back home. Pan-African, of course, means the inclusion of all African people globally in this effort and benefit. No matter how diverse or tainted our blood may be, we are one African family forming one nation, one Africa. Nationalism speaks to the political character of African people and turns our attention toward the motherland as the natural home of our political core. Nationalism also centers us in the land of question, directing our thoughts toward the need for a stable, protected, identifiable geographical place where we have our most ancient and profound roots. Socialism is directive of the nature of our interaction with each other, economic and otherwise. It makes the needs of individual people, their families, and surrounding community the society priority, the societal priority. A deep sense of honor and obligation rules this way of social relations. And, of course, this deeply personal priority goes all the way to the national level, but never loses its humanistic simplicity as we shift our focus from micro to macro levels. Affirm, my wealth is in my community. Affirm, my wealth is in my community. You know, even though that was yesterday's Enye Sasim, but isn't that apropos for what we were supposed to have this weekend with us lifting us? The economic development cooperative for our people in the spirit of Ujamaa, cooperative economics, or as we like to say, family-centered economics. Wasn't that apropos? It happens that way a lot of times with the Enye Sasim. Things that are happening, bam, there it is. March 13th. What do I care about death in the cause of the redemption of Africa? I would die anywhere in the cause of liberty. A real man dies but once. A coward dies 1,000 times before his real death. The Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey. There is no doubt that we are witnessing the fall of the Western Empire. The question is whether or not we are really prepared. Are we waiting for anarchy to pave the way by fractionalizing Europeans from the inside and then begin to consider our options with completely re-Africanized minds? Or are we doing self-liberating work while they destroy themselves? That's what I hope we're doing. Those tireless, brave warriors urging us towards spiritual, physical, psychological, and mental preparedness must be our dominant voice. The option of liberation must be made available to the ears of every awakening African. When voices rise from our African center, there should be a movement in the direction of those voices to secure and protect them. Every effort must be made to ensure that they are not silenced by external or externally governed internal forces. If you don't know what that means, what I just said, sellouts, Negroes, handkerchief heads. Every effort must be made to ensure that they are not silent by external or externally governed internal forces. We know our enemies. We know their methods for suppressing and silencing those who courageously guide our righteous rage through their words and actions. Our children are afraid to be Africans because they have read of and witnessed these murders. This can no longer be. Affirm, I am willing to die in the cause of our liberation. Affirm, I am willing to die in the cause of our liberation. March 14th. The necessary re-education of Africans and a possible solution of cultural crises can begin, strangely enough, only when Africans fully realize their central fact that in their lives, the European, the Caucasian, man is their bitter enemy. I repeat, the European, the Caucasian, and all those other adjectives, the white man is their bitter enemy. Chancellor Williams. Racial oppression or oppression period does not require a distance between a predator and victim. A racist can sleep every night with whom he or she racially inferiorizes and exploits. Insecure, unstable males still sleep with the wives and girlfriends they physically abuse. Deranged parents and guardians often provide clean, trendy, ample spaces in their residence for the children they mentally, physically, and or sexually exploit. This is the nature of socio and psychopaths. They keep their trophies. In practice, racist oppression works best in intimate, personally controlled environments, and even better when the victims believe the racist is not racist, i.e., the racist loves them, is doing it for their own good, and they themselves cause the just abused. European tactics encourage keeping the enemy even closer than friends. When you get down to basics, the most enduring racist acts committed by Europeans have been covert in the closet and in the closeness of company. They have been kept out of public sight while Europeans continue to systematically work to maintain an extreme unequal distribution of group power. Affirm, my enemy is my enemy. Nothing more, nothing less. I say affirm, my enemy is my enemy. Nothing more, nothing less. And they behaved in that way. Look what they have done to us. Look how we treat each other. We have to recognize. We have to recognize. Have a great program for you today. In the next hour, have Chief Ugumawali, who gave us the tour of Black Wall Street in the Greenwood District last week in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So I'm excited about that prospect. I hate the fact. I am so sorry. I just can't. Man, I'm just messed up because of our conference being called. Our conference being canceled. And I know many of us have done some good work to help promote our conference. And I know there's a lot of stuff that's already been bought, because as far as yesterday it was on, and today was the beginning, this evening with the meet and greet, and then tomorrow with a lot of good work. Itinerary for tomorrow and Sunday. But it's just a bump in the road, brothers and sisters, and we will bounce back, and we will handle our business, because that's what we as African people who are committed to the liberation of African people and self-determination and independence and sovereignty for African people is what we must do. It must be. It's not that if it doesn't happen that, Yeah, I feel that. Oh, well, but the bottom line is it will happen. It is not the end. It is never the end. The end game for us is liberation, self-determination, sovereignty. That is the end game. That is the end game. And so whatever we have to do, however it takes, you know, that's what we're going to do. Today's also Friday the 13th. That's right, brothers and sisters. Friday the 13th. And the spookiness of Friday the 13th. You know, they're always talking about Friday the 13th. You know, they got series, Friday the 13th, movies, and of course, being that day, I have streaming, so they have a couple of things on Friday the 13th this weekend, or today, whatever, you know, because what they wanted you to do is to believe that the number 13, and there's a word for that phobia, it's trescaidicaphobia. Trescaidicaphobia, the fear of the number 13. Friday the 13th. And of course, there was a stock market crash on that Friday the 13th, many back in the 20s. And there's other things that have happened that, you know, people believe. But really, the number 13 and Friday, there's no deep correlation. The bottom line is the number 13 is the number of transformation. That's right, brothers and sisters. Number 13 is not a bad number, evil number, as the society will want you to think or believe. They always like to keep you and keep your mind in some mysticism or some other kind of bull. But the number 13 is a number of transformation. When the European came here and took this country, how many colonies did they establish? 12? 10? 9? 13. They established 13 colonies. Why not 12 or 15? Those are good numbers too. You know why? Because the number 13 is the number of transformation. The people who took this country, I ain't talking about pilgrims or Puritans. I'm talking about the European Caucasians who were into masonry, who were into societal order. And they had knowledge that we once possessed, that they, of course, have co-opted and suppressed and appropriated. This was us. This was us. The number 13 in these societal orders of Masons and Shriners and so forth. The number 13 is the number of transformation. How many signs in the zodiac? 12 plus the sun? 13. How many disciples did Jesus have? 12 plus Jesus, 13. How many mythical knights, and there's a issue because many people believe that King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table is real. No, it's fiction. The European has, when you tell a story, just like what they said with Hitler and his propaganda, Goebbels, if you keep telling that story over and over again, it takes a life of being real. And of course, that's what Europeans have always done. That's why the religion that they have, Christianity, and somebody say, Brother Oshie, why are you jumping on Christianity? Only reason why I talk about Christianity, and I'm going to do it again, in fact, hopefully Sister Bonisi, why, and I've talked about it. We'll hopefully maybe come on to end of the, at the end of the month to help with that. But is to shed light and deal with fact and what's fact and what's fiction. You know? Because everything that the Christian religion is based on, it comes out of ancient Kemet. And there's so many books on that. So, but anyway, you know, the number 13, King Arthur had 12 knights at the round table plus King Arthur, 13. How many jurors on a trial? 12 jurors plus the judge, 13. So now you understand where this number 13 is and how important this number is in terms of transformation. 12 completes the cycle, 13 begins anew. For those who are back in the day, folks, if you went to the baker, although there's not a lot of bakeries around anymore, but if you went to the baker and you asked for a baker's dozen, you got 13 donuts. 13. Even on the dollar bill, the number 13 is repeated 13 times. 13 stars in the constellation, 13 stripes in the eagle's plate, 13 olive branches, 13 arrows, 13 feathers in his tail, 13 steps on a pyramid, 13 letters in E Pluribus Unum, because they understood what they were trying to do. They wanted to do here what we had done there thousands of years ago. That's why the city of Memphis is on the Mississippi River. That's why they used to play in a pyramid. And there was a statue of Ramesses on the front of the pyramid. I tried to see that when I went there to support Sister Marcy Lee in the passing of her mother, you know. But yeah, 13 times. The number 13, the number of transformation. 12 completes the cycle, 13 begins anew. So don't be tripping on this day, Friday the 13th. Although I'm very upset that our conference was canceled on Friday the 13th. We got a caller, 602. Good morning.
Good morning, Brother Oshie.
Hey, Brother Marcus. How are you today, brother?
I'm doing all right, good brother. I just want to pivot a little bit to this virus here that they got everybody scrambling about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am convinced that these people unleashed this thing on the planet at this time, you know, because it's kind of strange that just when we talking about moving to Africa and making our move, bam, this thing jump up.
Yeah.
Also, as China is making moves, bam, this thing here jump up.
Right.
So, these people don't stop, man. As, you know, they don't stop with the Machiavelli. But I hope this virus eliminate the mass majority of them being it's over there in Europe. So, and it's being spread through Europe.
Very
Europeans
bad.
In this country.
Yeah.
So all them black folks that ran to the white people neighborhood, no, you better think twice.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are the ones who are transmitting this thing now.
Right. Well, you know what I've... Listen up. What I read recently is a good friend of mine. I seen two pieces on it. One was one like, why are no black people getting this, you know? And, of course, the two basketball players for the Utah basketball team in the NBA, that's why them getting the virus. Rudy Gobert, who is French, and... the other brother getting the virus. And, of course, that really shut down the NBA and it actually shut down all athletics because they got the virus. That shut because they were going to play those games with no attendance. But they realized sweating and so forth and all its contact. And so they just said shut it down. But the interesting is that when somebody said there are no Africans getting this disease, on the continent, there's only been two cases in the North Africa, and I think a few in the South Africa. Only two deaths, one in Morocco and one in Egypt. And the person in Egypt was visiting, And so,
was a German.
Yeah, exactly. Was a German. And so, really, it's interesting that Africa is not hit with this virus, but Europe is. Europe. It was China initially coming out of China and South Korea, but they have put a hold on it. They have done some probably some things that helped them. And to me, if you got to do some serious things, just like Cuba, when the AIDS crisis hit, there's no problem with AIDS in Cuba. Well, number one, they quarantined people. They took you out of your situation and put you here and you were isolated. It wasn't like they didn't feed you. They didn't, but they understood that we can't have this spread amongst the people because of the high cost that it that we're, what that is what's happening right now in this country. You know the fact that they postponed our conference, the Us Lifting Us conference, the ULU conference. Because it's on the campus of the Atlanta University system, Morehouse, Spelman, Morris Brown, you know, and Atlanta University. And the whole campus is shut down, you know? And so, at this such a short of time, it's going to be very difficult for us to find a venue and so forth. So I'm like, but I mean, you know, I ain't scared.
No, I ain't scared. You just got to eat right, take your lot of vitamins.
Exactly.
Reinforce your system, you know, because, you know. But the thing what I'm kind of nervous about is that they could use this thing to quarantine us.
Yeah.
You see? They could use this as a thing to say, you know what, we're going to quarantine an entire... You know, so it's not something to play with these people. Because, as I said, knowing them, we know how they operate.
Right.
They
right.
will unleash something on the entire planet to stay in power. And
there's no doubt about that, Marcus. I put nothing past them. Yeah, I put nothing.
Real Machiavelli, my brother. But I thank you for the program, and I'm listening.
Oh, please do. I got Brother Chief Ugamawali on. Coming on to talk about the massacre and the destruction of the Greenwood District of Black Wall Street. I attended there I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma last weekend, and this brother is fantastic. So please stick around, okay?
Yes.
All right, my brother. Thank you. Thank you. So, yeah, I'm down with what Marcus is saying, you know? I put nothing past him. And so, therefore... Even in this idea of the number 13, the number is a month, number of transformation. So I'm going to try to do this quickly because I want to go to a break because I want to make sure I give Brother Chief Ugamawali as much time in the second half. But understand something. We need to put the number 13 in our lives, in Africans' lives, for us to be a better people, to transform us. How can we do that? How can we put the number 13 into our daily lives that we will be the best people that we can be, that we will move towards justice, that we move towards independence, self-determination, liberation, and sovereignty for African people globally? Number one, take the Nguza Saba, the seven principles of Kwanzaa. Umoja, unity. Kujijagalia, self-determination. Ujima, collective working responsibility. Ujamaa, cooperative economics. Nia, purpose. Kumba, creativity. And Imani, faith. You got those seven? Hold them. Add to the seven, five C's. The first C, consciousness. Consciousness, brothers and sisters. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are culturally, who you are historically, consciousness. Because you have consciousness, you develop courage. Because you have consciousness, you develop courage. You feel good about yourself. You feel you can challenge anything. You can overcome whatever obstacles or pitfalls or detours are put in your path. You have courage. And because of that courage, you have confidence. Confidence is, I ain't talking about ego. I ain't talking about tripping. I'm talking about confidence. A confidence that lets you know I can pass the test. I can get the job. I can get the promotion. I can overcome whatever obstacle is put in my path because I have consciousness, courage, and confidence. The fourth C is conscience. Knowing what is morally right and wrong and doing what is right. Standing on principle. Standing on a solid foundation. And then the fifth C is conviction. No matter what time it is, no matter if you try to start something, if you had a plan, and sometimes plans don't always go the way that you want them to go, but because you have a plan, even when there is some disruption, you continue on with your plan because why? You have conviction. You will eventually be a doctor, an attorney, a firefighter, whatever it is. Because you have conviction. So now you have the seven principles of unity, self-determination, collective responsibility, cooperative economics, purpose, creativity, faith. Added to those seven, you added the five C's of consciousness, courage, confidence, conscience, and conviction. How much is 7 plus 5? 6 plus you? 13, brothers and sisters. That's how you can add the number 13 into our daily lives. To be the kind of men and women that we must be, of respect and nobility. Brothers and sisters, we're going to take a break. When we come back from the break, I will be talking with Chief Ugumawali and talking about what happened in 1921 in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and how Tulsa, Oklahoma developed, how it all happened, and what happened after that, and what's happening today. Brothers and sisters, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on TimeForAnAwakening.com, and BlackTalkRadioNetwork.com. You stay with us. We'll be right back.
You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at TimeForAnAwakening@gmail.com.
Well, 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 well
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Once again, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. I'm going to get right off into the discussion with my brother, Brother Chief Ugumawale. Brother Chief Ugumawale, how are you? How are you today?
I'm wonderful. How are you, sir?
I am doing well. Thank you for spending some time with us here on African Perspectives to talk about the destruction and the massacre that happened in 1921 in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes, sir.
You know, I tell you, you did an outstanding, and I'm quite sure you have done this so many times, an outstanding job of presenting that information to our people. And so, in fact, what is your daughter's name again?
Her name is Takara Olufemi.
Takara Olufemi, yeah. My daughter's name is Tachara.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah. But let us talk about the history from the beginning. I know that a lot of our people came to Oklahoma through the Trail of Tears.
They were part of the freedmen and so forth. And give us that history leading up to and how Tulsa, the Greenwood District, and how it evolved to becoming Black Wall Street.
So you have it's important that people understand the involvement that these people had in the Trail of Tears, the five so-called civilized tribes, and how treaties were enacted, how these African people who were with those people came as slaves, not as citizens, not as freedmen. They were enslaved by those tribes. Basically, I look at it, I liken it into a transfer of property. You know, like if the government wanted to get out of paying 40 acres and a mule, how brilliant is that? You basically transfer property and make it somebody else's property, right? Now you no longer have that debt to pay from that stand, from that perspective. But those people came, and you also had Black people who were already here before they came on through the Trail of Tears, because there were a lot of Africans in this country, in Oklahoma, because it was Indian territory. It's like no man's land. And this is a place where all the outlaws came, and you know, people who needed to be away from the rest of civilization, they came to Oklahoma. You know, and there were already tribes here before the five civilized tribes came to Oklahoma. But long story short, after the Black people, the African people who came to Oklahoma, when they got here, they essentially, the tribes were ordered to give them allotments of land or make them full blood citizens. So they chose to give them allotments of land, primarily the Creek, because that was one of the dominant tribes here at that time. And the Creek they had to give each freedman 160 acres of land. That's a lot of land.
That is a lot of land.
Wow. Yes. Right? Wow. So if you had, let's say you got three or four children with you, you multiply that.
Mm-hmm.
Each child gets 160 acres plus your spouse, 160 acres of land each. Now, why is that important? It's important because what's the number one produce of Oklahoma? Oil.
Oil. Yeah.
So now you got, overnight you have wealthy, super wealthy Black men, women, and children who have oil on their land. This is pre-Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
And you have people like Sarah Rector, who was 11 years old, when the wealthiest little girls in Oklahoma. You have so many different people who became like the Fords and the Rockefellers and all of the wealthy families that are commonly known in the United States of America. We know these, you know, we know those names, but we don't know the names of our own people who were just as wealthy. So, excuse me. Those people came and they established these townships, about 50 Black townships in Oklahoma. So then you have Tulsa, which is a city. And people start to migrate into Tulsa. And I'm condensing the story because it's a lot. But they migrate primarily because of people like Edwin B. McCabe, who wanted to create Oklahoma as an all-Black state. He was undermined. So Oklahoma almost became an all-Black state. Hold on. Okay. Mm-hmm. So Oklahoma almost became an all-Black state, and most people do not know that.
Mm-hmm.
Edwin B. McCabe is the founder of Langston, Oklahoma.
Oh, Langston University. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And they founded the first airport. So Black people had a place to train. Even Tuskegee Airmen flew into Langston, Oklahoma. You know, so it made sense that you had six Black people who owned planes, private planes in Oklahoma during that time period.
Wow.
Right? And so we're talking about a population, a very small population in Tulsa in 1902. as early as 1902.
What was that population about? Around
about 2,000 people.
How many?
That's right. About 2,000.
2,000, okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because you already had, most people don't know this, but there was already a township in Tulsa outside the Greenwood District. So they developed, they were developing, you know, mm-hmm. another hidden secret about mm-hmm. Tulsa. So the impetus was there, you know, the small blueprint model was there. Mm-hmm. So they developed and the population rapidly increased. So by 1921, you had an excess of 11,000 to 15,000 people in the Tulsa district alone. Mm. Right. So when you think Black Wall Street, don't think street. Think district. Think township. Mm-hmm. You know, because the infrastructure was there for an entire town to be built. Self-sustained. Self-built. Self-funded. Self-managed. Right? And so you hear a lot of people say, you know, Jim Crow is responsible for creating that wealth. That is the biggest lie you could ever believe in. And as I explained, if you had black people in Oklahoma in the 1800s who already had 160 acres of land and who were becoming wealthy, and then you had other wealthy black men coming to Oklahoma mm-hmm. from other states because of Edwin B. McCabe, you know, he sent out recruiters to bring people to Oklahoma to build, to develop, and to create wealth. You got a lot of ingenuity and a lot of wealth coming into Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. Jim Crow had nothing to do with that. Jim Crow was nothing more than a stimulus package for the economic growth that expanded Greenwood even further. Mm-hmm. You know, so you figure by the time Greenwood is at its prime, the United States is heading into a financial crisis, going through depression.
That's right. That's
so you
right.
got white citizens looking at Greenwood and saying, wait a minute, how are these people thriving? And we're entering a depression. And we just got over the Spanish flu, mm-hmm. which black people really were more or less immune to at the time.
Well, it's a little segue very quickly. That is what is being discussed today with the with the coronavirus. Some people says, why are not a lot of black people getting coronavirus? There's a lot of hypotheses out there, and I don't want to spread any rumor, but it needs to be looked at. But go ahead. Go ahead, Chief.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you look at that, and so now you got all these satellite townships surrounding Tulsa, because Tulsa's like everything you could possibly imagine. If you put Harlem, Bourbon Street, any of the major meccas, any of the major black mecca, you know, places that we look up to, landmarks that black African people look up to, all of it existed in Greenwood. All of it. Even the Cotton Club. Cotton mm-hmm. Club was in Greenwood long before Cotton Club in New York. You know, there was nothing that a person could not need. So if you had, you know, people say, how is it possible to have 600 businesses in a community 4-square-mile area, because that's what we're talking about. 4 square miles destroyed during the massacre, during that terrorist attack. How is it possible that you have so many businesses and there's no issue as it relates to competition? Well, it's very simple. If I decide I'm going to be a doctor, how can I accommodate 11,000 citizens plus the 500 who come in on a daily basis through the rail system? Who have to come to Greenwood thanks to Jim Crow. It's not possible. You're going to have surgeons, doctors, and in excess, real estate agents, you know, your agriculture people, your seamstresses, your everything, your real estate, anything you can think of, anything that we have, your educators. You can't have enough. Not to mention, if Jim Crow, I'm telling you, these people were idiots. When it comes, Jim Crow was a blessing, and I'll explain another reason why. Because now, in your elementary schools, in your middle schools, in your high schools, you have all of these teachers who are qualified as professors teaching your children.
Right.
Because they can't teach in any other institution. Mm-hmm. And Langston is the only black institution in the state of Oklahoma.
We were totally...
So we didn't have a choice but to be brilliant.
Right. We were totally, we were totally self-contained.
That's right.
We didn't look
for
anybody.
Norm.
Exactly. Black excellence. Beautiful. Yes.
Yeah, that was a norm, mm-hmm. not an exception. It was a norm. You didn't mm-hmm. have to say black excellence. You knew you were excellent.
Yes.
That was the only option for you.
Mm-hmm. Because it was all around. You've seen it. You felt it every day.
Every day. Every day. Well, Olivia Hooker, a survivor, she said, and a good friend, she said, and I implore your listeners to look up Dr. Olivia Hooker. She passed at 103.
Right. She passed 2 years ago. 2 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And she said, just to show you what Wakanda looked like, yeah, to give you a mindset, before Wakanda was thought of in a fictional form, we had already created it, not just in the United States, but all over the globe.
Yeah,
we created many Wakandas. But in Oklahoma, we built our Wakanda, and oil was our vibranium.
Yep, Ashe.
Our culture was our vibranium, mm-hmm. right? So when we look at that and we look at what we established here, it's unparalleled. It's unparalleled because people who read about it, they get a marginalized version of what Greenwood was about, right? So it's easy to stick it in the bucket with everything else that we've done, mm-hmm. right? Because, and that's why you see all this focus on the massacre, but you don't see focus on the blueprint.
Mm.
Like, where are all the photos pre-destruction? Where are all the photos after we rebuilt Greenwood
mm-hmm.
in 1925, 85% to normalcy, and built it better than it was the first time in brick?
Now, right. And 'cause that home that is on the Greenwood Center is a testament. That home was moved there, correct?
Yes, it was moved there.
Yeah, that's a beautiful home. But that is the model of the type of homes that were built by
that's
brothers
right.
and sisters in the Greenwood community. Now, you mentioned in 1925, did they build it back up with the amount of commercialism that it had prior to 1921?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. So, and it was in its renaissance in 1950.
Okay.
And yeah, they built it all back up better than it was the first time. And that that commercial wealth was even greater.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you have even greater impetus, right? Like, you know, people would ask me, what kind of people? Most of us would move out of our houses if we got robbed and our house got burned down at the same time. We would never come back to that house,
mm-hmm.
especially if the insurance company wasn't paying. These people came back, rebuilt, to prove a point. It was like the ultimate insult to their wickedness would be to reproduce greater than what we had.
Mm-hmm.
Insult to ourselves would be to try to reproduce and become dependent upon them and to marginalize our own ability. I mean, you're talking about the people who had already built a nation. They had already built the country, a whole entire country.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of people we're dealing with here. Right. So to build a community was nothing. They're like, well, and to have your community destroyed. They look at that. You think about that. What? In the eyes of those people, what had they already experienced? Most of them had already experienced what it meant, what it felt like to be chattel slave, involved in chattel slavery. You already knew what that looked like. What mm-hmm. could be worse than being a slave? Not the burning down of your community, right? And then the narrative, I hope your listeners understand, because I read a lot of stories and a lot of commentary on different podcasts and stories, and people, you know, always talk about, well, you know, that's why we need a defense mechanism to defend our communities. And most people don't know about the fight, the Battle of Greenwood, the fight against tyranny, the fight against the destruction, because they'll never talk about the heroes of Black Wall Street. They'll never talk about the J.B. Straffords. They'll never talk about the Horace Peg Leg Taylors, mm-hmm. who occupied a hill for 6 hours by himself with a machine gun. You don't hear about right?
On so one leg. Oh, drag right. that! He dragged that gun up that hill.
That's right,
man.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, and so you look at that and you think, you again have to say, who were these people? Because people put a lot of focus on Greenwood and, you know, the entrepreneurship and what was built there. But that's not what created that. Those people created that. You have to know the people. You have to understand what kind of people we're dealing with, because we have to replicate that brilliance. We have to replicate that ingenuity. We have to replicate that warrior spirit, that entrepreneur spirit. We have to replicate that. Mm-hmm. But you can't replicate it if you don't know the mindset and the kind of people we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You're talking about Peg Leg was an entrepreneur before he went to World War I. He came back to Jim Crow, tried to do, you know, had his sons. They were brilliant carpenters. And had his family, you know, his sons were great carpenters. They continued on with the family business. But Peg Leg knew, like Du Bois said, you better go and defend your communities. Mm-hmm. You better know how to defend your communities and stop these lynchings. So they had to bomb Greenwood. You cannot. They could not win. The city, it was the city versus a township of black people. The whole entire city. And they were losing.
Until.
That's right.
Until they dropped a bomb.
They said the only recourse is we're going to have to bomb. We're going to have to bomb these places.
Mm-hmm.
There's no other way we're going to win this battle. And then the wealthiest homes in Greenwood, they didn't even get burnt down because the white mobs said there's no way black people lived in a house like that, so leave that house alone.
Mm.
That lets you know that there were people who weren't even from here, had no understanding of what existed in Greenwood.
At the time,
that's what happens when you have orchestrated attack.
At the time of the massacre, what was the population numbers of Greenwood in percentage?
Well, they say it was the official number is 11,000, but I've heard it's in excess of 15,000.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what was the population of Caucasians?
In Greenwood district?
Yeah, in Greenwood. No, not in Greenwood. No, not because I know there.
Oh,
I mean
in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
In Oklahoma.
No, in Tulsa. Yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't have that number.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, because I know that, you know, that the railroad track, the Fresno or Frisco Railroad.
Yeah, Frisco Railroad.
Yeah, that's the dividing line. Like, I mean, there's a lot of cities around this country. There's a physical dividing line. I know in Milwaukee, I'm from Milwaukee, the viaduct has divided the city of Milwaukee between north and south. And at the time I was coming up, we did not live on the south side of Milwaukee. In fact, you were taking your life in your hands. Even when we went to open housing march, and open housing was being pushed in the 60s, I participated in one open housing march, and they pelted us with bottles, bricks, and so forth, you know. And we had a good number of people, man, but yeah. But, you know, so I understand. I can physically feel and see that situation there in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's the same situation, but a little bit different because – we didn't want to go across the track. We wanted to be left alone, you know?
Yes. Yes. And that was the same was true in Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
The same was true in Tulsa. It was like, there was no need to.
Right.
You know, and that's where I was going with Olivia Hooker. Olivia Hooker said, I didn't even know racism existed until the massacre. That means that little girl, the world she lived in, was so protected that they made sure that they were immune to just the knowledge of wickedness on that level. They were trying to create a true Wakanda for themselves, a true environment of, like, who wants to live next to the person who informally enslaved them? Who wants to live next to your oppressor? Nobody.
Mm-hmm.
They said, in fact, we didn't build houses better than the ones you live in.
And that was the animosity.
What could we possibly want?
Yeah. And that's what caused the animosity and the jealousy and the envy and the hatred and mean-spiritedness of Caucasians.
Right. The only time we needed to cross the tracks is because you had a population of black people who worked for white people. Mm-hmm. Who worked in their homes, you know, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
But even those people were like, this is like a retirement fund, right? The work I do for you is a retirement fund so that I can go and develop and establish myself. And that's what the majority of those people did.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I had the opportunity to ride around Tulsa with you and my other brothers and sisters I was with, and I was looking, and it just reminded me so much of the situation that happened in Milwaukee, but on a deeper scale, because unlike Milwaukee, just like I mentioned a moment ago, that, you know, we were trying to integrate. We were trying to say, hey, we should be able to live anywhere we want to live if we have the money to live there. You know, we should not mm-hmm. be restricted. But in Tulsa's situation, they were saying, we don't need to go nowhere. We have all that we need right here. Right. And we just wanted to be left alone because, just like you said, they had the oil money, but what made the city develop and grow was the people who came there to provide goods and services because, and so how many times did that money circulate in that community before it ever went out?
30, I've heard 30 times. The most common is 35 times.
Wow.
And I've heard excess of 50, but the most common statement is 35 times.
Can you imagine today?
That's right.
That money don't circulate, but if it circulates even once, it's a blessing. That's a damn shame. Even once, it's a blessing.
Yeah.
You know, I live here in Atlanta, man. And here in Atlanta, with the gentrification that is going around in the neighborhood that I live in, I live right in the city, you know, because the thing about Atlanta, if you're not familiar, people say, I live in Atlanta. Well, Atlanta's a small city. There's only 400,000 people in the city of Atlanta. But the metropolitan area of Atlanta, because Atlanta's in five counties, is well over 4 million people, well over 40 million people. And we don't even own a supermarket here in Atlanta. We don't have a strip mall that is solely ours. We don't provide, you know what I'm saying? It's really pathetic, you know. But there in Tulsa was the model of self-sufficiency.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But you know what?
I mean,
I said on a program prior to that, I talked about the other massacres, the other impositions on our people in, you know, in Atlanta, St. Louis, Elaine, Arkansas, Allentown, all of these places, of course, Rosewood, all of these places, you know, where the meanness and the evilness and the jealousy and envy and hatred of Europeans came vamping on our communities. These weren't riots. We did riot in the 60s because we were trying to make a stand. That's what you can consider a riot. And in fact, they were in our community. We just destroying some property, you know, until the police come and then we got to fight them. But these were massacres. These people vamped on our community. They tried to restrict our movement. They tried to impound on us and control our very lives by them doing to what they were doing to us. And hey, you know, we just said, we want to be left alone. You know, you already say we can't go to your places, then damn, we don't want to go.
That's right. That's right. That's what made Oklahoma so popular. That's what made Oklahoma so welcoming. Because you had one state known as Indian Territory, no man's land. Who want to come to Oklahoma? We got to worry about nothing. But as soon as they found out these people got resources, then you have Boomer Sooners, Oklahoma land run.
Yep.
You're running folks off their property, and you're creating laws to make sure blacks and native people don't intermingle. And, you know, all of these laws are established to ensure that you cannot. And then you tax all that acreage of land that has been allocated to these African people. That's how you make a real impact and to ensure your own lifeline. That's what they did, to try to ensure their own lifeline, because they knew there was absolutely no way these people could end up owning the whole southern part of America at the rate in which they were developing.
Yeah.
Just based on oil wealth. Oklahoma's still pumping oil. We can't even fathom the degree of wealth. Now we're doing gas. Gas is the number one producer. We're number one producer of gas. So he's like, okay. The wealth, the attainment of wealth, and the theft of land was critical. But then we said, okay, let's do this commerce thing, right? We already got 50 townships in the area. They still can't compete. We ain't got to worry about them. Y'all don't worry about us. We don't worry about you.
Mm-hmm.
Do our thing. You know, we're not thinking. You know what? We still behind enemy lines. Them veterans got it. They understood it. They said, no, we can't. We're not going to let this happen again. Never again. They were like the Jews. Never again.
Mm-hmm.
No more lynching. Right? Because you have people like J.B. Stafford in Oklahoma.
Yeah,
who
J.B. Stafford.
Personally
yeah.
stopped lynchings.
Yeah.
You know, and this was unheard of. Like, who do these black people think they are? They literally come into the courthouse building and saying, not tonight. We'll take care of that. That's the kind of stuff that's happening in Oklahoma. So you're hearing about the bloody summers of 1919. These brothers are like, we'll have to get bloody then, because that's not going to happen. We built too much here. Mm-hmm. We've established too much here. We own too much here. We're part of the land. We're part of the soil. We're part of the ground. This is sacred land now.
Mm-hmm.
We got people in the ground. It's sacred land now, right? Because land is everything. To both blacks, to the indigenous people who came, or the natives who came here, and the Africans. Mm-hmm. They like land is everything, no right. matter where you go in the globe.
That's right. You know, when reparations were being dealt with, particularly for the Trail of Tears and the indigenous, the Crete Indians, I remember, mm-hmm. Which is disheartening to me, because when the deal was struck with the United States government to pay them, the indigenous people said, you have to be full-blooded in order
right.
for you to participate in this. And I remember this one sister, you know, she had the two braids on the side and so forth, and her and her husband were building a home, and he passed. And so she still couldn't get her home built, and yet that settlement should have been part of what she should have received, but didn't, you know, and many
right.
others. And
right.
what is that situation still today? Because that was a long time ago. What is that situation?
Well, the Creeks still have not. They've already kicked the freedmen out of the tribe, you know, and that's still an ongoing fight.
Mm-hmm.
Both, even with the Cherokee, you know, that's as they say, that's customary.
Mm-hmm.
But that fight is still prevalent. That's still the reality, you know. So they're still fighting for their rights as freedmen
mm-hmm.
to this very day.
Well, once again, it's what Dr. John Henry Clark said: we have no friends.
Mm-hmm.
As African people, we have no friends.
Yeah.
You know, and further says, if you want a friend, go look in the mirror. Don't leave that mirror till you like what you see, not the cleft in your chin or your dimples or your arched eyebrows. No, like who
right.
you see culturally, historically, like who you see, the color of your skin, and like those who look like you, and work with those who look like you. Because, man, yeah, you know, and you know, it's really kind of tough, because I know that we've done this, proving it can be done, no doubt about it. But we had it done in other places as well, such as Rosewood. Rosewood is another kind of example of that, a thriving community because of segregation. So we make sure that we had what we need amongst ourselves. And then there's that jealousy, and there's that envy and mean, ugly spiritedness of the European. And then they're going to find any excuse. Of course, the main excuse is the accosting of a white woman. And so if that happens, oh, now we got to defend her honor. You know, we got to go over there and kill every damn body. You know,
right.
not the perpetrator, do we kill everybody and destroy it all?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and take what we want and destroy it all. You know, you're talking about 40 blocks. And just like you said, what I loved about how you presented it, you had pictures of what it looked like
yes.
prior to the destruction. To
right.
give you an idea and an example of what it looked like, you know.
Right, and after the destruction, you know, because mm-hmm. you can't. It's like me talking to you about the Great Pyramids all over the planet, but you don't know what it looked like. So you have to use your imagination to try to conceive what I'm talking about. Then, even in your greatest imagination, you still fail because there's nothing like visually being able to see what was there. I know the first time I went to Africa in 98, you know, I couldn't fathom what liberation meant truly, because a fight for freedom and what we lost. I couldn't really comprehend what was lost until I tasted it, till I saw it, till I heard it, till I felt it. And I said, oh my God, this is what we lost.
Right.
This is really what we lost. Our connection to everything, you know, to our land, to our language, to our culture, to everything, you know. And I thought, and all this time I kept talking about what I lost, and it's in the grasp of my hands. All I had to do was get on a plane and go.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And so all the energy I spent talking about what I lost, I could have been going to get. And that's what I dedicated my life to. And even with as it relates to Greenwood, you know, as I said earlier, I'm a descendant of Raymond Beard Sr., who was my grandfather, who fled during the massacre. They lost their property again due to eminent domain in the 90s. And so, you know, it was like a double whammy, you know, and not to mention model cities and urban removal in the 60s, you know. So just it's been, that's why I tell people we don't have when it comes to oppression, we don't have a past. We have concurrent offenses.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's concurrent. There's a connection. Past, present, and future. It's all connected.
Especially,
you know, so when somebody says, get over it, it's in the past. No, there is no past. No. This is concurrent.
Exactly. Because it is theirs, not ours.
That's
And they constantly will show you and tell you and prove to you that it is there. They do what they want. I mean, you look at other communities that it happened to. It happened in Milwaukee. They ran the expressway through a good American-African community in Milwaukee and just devastated it. Recently, reading about the Hittite community in Raleigh-Durham, same thing happened there. You know, here you had a thriving. In fact, I think they tried to even call Raleigh-Durham Black Wall Street because they had a number of insurance companies and banks and so forth, you know. And then they ran that, you know, expressway through there, the Model Cities program, and there went that community, you know.
Right.
See.
Right.
See, that's one thing.
You know, reparations, the fight for reparations, you know, it was a real fight here, because all of these survivors who remember their stories, you know, they opened their hearts up and told their stories. And I remember I was doing security for Johnny Cochran when he came, and he was fighting with Dr. Ogletree and Professor Ogletree and other members. And I remember we were backstage right before he was getting ready to be called out to speak. And I asked him, I said, so how do you think this is going to impact our fight for justice as it relates to reparations? What do you think the outcome is going to be? And he said, we're going to win. He said, we have to win, because to be honest with you, if we win in Greenwood, we set the standard. We set the precedent for reparations in the United States of America, because this fits everything that we need. So you got people like John Kyans, who was trying to do H.R. 40 and saying we need a study. And that was just, you know, just to get the United States government just to study the effects of slavery.
Right.
Enslavement of Africans. Right. So what happens when you have a real life test like Oklahoma, and you can put it to, because we're talking about military involvement, police involvement, right? State and local involvement, law enforcement, everybody's involved in the massacre, and we have the evidence.
Right.
So you have all the accountability to say, this is your government versus the people. Not a bunch of vigilante white folks who just decided they envious of white, black people. No, it was deeper than that.
Right.
Much deeper than that.
See, and that's why a sister like Miss Hooper, who lived all her life, she wanted to see the day that there would be some kind of, you know, redemption, some kind of compensation that it happened. I remember about, I think the 75th year when the massacre happened, it was on Nightline. I remember distinctly, I'm a retired firefighter. I was in the firehouse watching that program when a Oklahoma legislator adamantly.
Yeah, Don Ross. Yeah.
Oh, you okay? There, adamantly going against reparations. He didn't even want a marker. He wanted you to forget it.
Yeah.
He just wanted you to say it happened, it's over, it's done, forget about it, and now let's move on. You know, he was so arrogant. I just went to go through the TV, man. You know what I'm saying? But
Don Ross, former Congressman, former Representative Don Ross, he lit him up over that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But see,
I remember that.
But see, here you have bona fide individuals who lost everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's not to say that because of our captivity and our subjugation and so forth and our, that we should be paid for all the stuff we've done. That's understandable and that's true. But now here you have individuals who had property, who had wealth, who had businesses, all of these things. And then you're going to say no to them as well?
That's
just
right.
Shows you, you know, the injustices that happen here. We got a caller. I'm going to take this call. Okay, brother? Chief?
Sure.
646, good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon, OC, you and your guest.
Good afternoon, Jay.
Good afternoon.
Nice conversation going. You know, my only question when they talk about reparations is, what do we have in place to make a demand that they give us reparations? Because it seems to me, all we're doing is talking. We have nothing in place to make it to where they give us reparations or to really honestly even address it and deal with it. You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, we had everything in place, right? I know for a fact that the mistake was creating a commission to do the research and investigation, right? Now, don't get me wrong. The commission was necessary. The problem is when you add riot to the word commission, then you create a presentation to promote mutual accountability.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's a book called 100 Years of, and I recommend that you get that book because it helps you understand that anytime a commission is created, under the guise of riots, it is to ascertain whether or not there is mutual accountability so that you can justify the use of the word riot. Right?
What's the name of that
now,
book again?
Other,
what is Chief?
The other part of this.
Hey, Chief.
To answer the. Yes, sir.
Chief, what is the name of that book again?
100 Years of Riot Commission.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. The other part of that is their ancestors now, but when my grandparents took their case to the Supreme Court, they didn't lose because they didn't have a case. They didn't lose because they didn't have the information. They lost because of the statute of limitations had passed. So another mistake was made, which was not adding to the defense or to the argument that there was no recourse in the illegal system at that time period for people because the whole judicial system was run by the Klan, the same Klan that committed the offense.
Mm-hmm.
So what the Klan did in order to remove themselves from any accountability is they would purge the Klan rolls before they went to court in the 20s. When a military tribunal was held, military court was held because Oklahoma was under martial law. So they purged the Klan rolls before they would have to go to court so that when they made the oath, when they were made to testify under oath, they could say, well, I'm not a member of that organization that committed these offenses. So you avoid any accountability.
But see, there is no statute of limitation. See, that's why, to me, that word riot was problematic with that commission. It was very problematic because what happened was they vamped on that community, you know, under the skies of some Caucasian woman being accosted with, Dick Rowland and Sarah.
Yeah, Dick Rowland and Sarah Page.
Page. And you had an interesting hypothesis about that as well. and how that went down.
Yeah, I do. And it's, you know, like I said, it's my own personal theory. Well, on a couple of levels. First of all, look at the date that happened on. Memorial Day weekend. What is the department store doing open on Memorial Day weekend? That's my first issue. Second issue, everybody knew that Dick Rowland and Sarah Page ran the streets a lot. That wasn't like an uncommon thing. That's why when the sheriff came and got him, he just simply detained him in the courthouse building until the crowd could die down. Right? But that wasn't, that it didn't happen like that. The powers that be saw it as an opportunity to do what they had already been planning to do. To take that land from the people who resided in Greenwood. Because it sat right in the middle of prime real estate. You got three rail systems that go around the whole community. So from the standpoint of infrastructure and development, it was perfect. It was absolutely perfect. And their development was not going to stop as long as that existed. Again, you had a trolley system that ran right down the middle of Greenwood. That trolley system brought people from all over. So you got in excess of 500 people possibly visiting on a daily basis that community is trying to accommodate. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. it's just a really powerful piece of history.
Yeah.
A powerful example of the legacies that we have created.
Right. I think what it consistently has shown us, you know, I read there's a brother, Baba Mwalimu Baruti. I don't know if you know Baba Baruti, but he has a book called The Inye Sesem, which is a daily revolutionary thoughts. And,
okay.
You know, there's a saying by a noted individual, and then there's his narrative after that. And and what was interesting is that tomorrow, which is March 14th, the saying is from Chancellor Williams. The necessary reeducation of blacks and a possible solution of racial crises can begin, strangely enough, only when blacks fully realize this central fact in their lives. The white man is their bitter enemy.
Mm.
And then, of course, Baba Baruti takes it from there. And I think that for us, we don't understand that we're constantly begging, pleading, hoping, voting, all of these things that having a constant wish and prayer that the European, the Caucasian, or the white man has an epiphany. That he realizes how evil he has been and will say to us, I you know, I'm so sorry. You come and share and I will compensate you for your loss. Because to me, though, Brother Chief, the prime example is that situation in Tulsa should have been rectified. It should have been compensation from the state of Oklahoma, the city of Tulsa, and those citizens. That is clear because those brothers and sisters had land. They were how many people they estimated that were dead? I know the official number was like 30-something people.
Yeah, so I'm on the mass graves committee. We're doing this investigation of the mass graves with the city, and I'm on the mass graves oversight committee. So it's interesting you asked that question because I tell people if we had a population, let's go with the low number. If we had a population of 11,000, the National Guard, the Red Cross report in excess of 6,000 people that they accommodated, right? Mm-hmm. That leaves 5,000 people unaccounted for. Let's say 1,000 were able to get out of town with men, women, and children and find a place of refuge. Let's say 2,000.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, that still leaves you 3,000.
Right.
Unaccounted for. Right? Now you got these concentration camp areas where people said they never saw their people come out of them places again. Then you got I got white testimony on camera where people have said that their parents or their grandparents witnessed them dump excess of 300 bodies in one location. That's one witness account. Another lady says her grandfather drove a trolley, and they took the trolleys and dumped them in the river, dumped bodies in the river. Another guy said they ordered nine, a historian says they ordered nine tons of ice. And I couldn't figure out why they would need 9 tons of ice until I got an email from somebody who said that they believed that they used the cadavers at Oklahoma University. Right? And I said, oh, well, now that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because I got testimony of people saying they put the bodies on trains. 9 tons of ice. I said, okay, now it's starting to add up. Mm-hmm. You start to look at so you put start putting all this evidence together, right? Because what happens is we rely on white media
right.
for documentation at a time when even the governor himself put a gag order on the white media because of what they were inciting during the time period. But most people look for articles and microfiche items and say, well, you know, we can find documentation. But who look at who's the author of the documentation?
Mm-hmm.
Right? They marginalize the number. They're saying about 10, 12, 35, 30, 100. But not more than that. Surely not. Now we got mass graves that we're looking into.
Right.
And we're saying, okay, now we're getting somewhere. Because one of the things some of the survivors, I had a lot of friends who were survivors, and my grandparents had survivor friends who were that were best friends. Well, one of the survivors, and I love him dearly, Baba Wes Young, he told me, he said, after they got back from the Supreme Court, he said, Chief, don't you stop fighting. He said, because there's no statute of limitations on murder.
That's right. And that's what they were.
No
they
statute
were,
of limitations on murder.
To me, right. the word massacre goes with murder.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And
but
that's what I'm
but
saying.
Again, when we use the wrong language.
Right.
When we use the wrong language and we fail to understand and comprehend that this man's language is very intentional and how he used those words are very intentional. Mm-hmm. And we have to stop letting people marginalize our history, marginalize our heroes, marginalize our efforts and our legacy. Until we do that, and we start to, that's why we call our tour the Real Black Wall Street Tour, because we don't want people to have this watered down version. It's not what you can find in books. It's not what you can, the stuff they show you is what they want you to see.
Mm-hmm.
You got to dig deeper. It's the stuff they don't let you see, the stuff that you don't. So when you start asking, well, where are all the photos at of pre-massacre? Where are the photos at after massacre?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you got people donating all this stuff to the Smithsonian. The majority of the stuff that they get sent to the Smithsonian and the African American Museum, you won't even see in the 1921 massacre exhibit. You're gonna see what you allowed to see.
Right.
I know for a fact that this white journalist who lived in Tulsa who suddenly committed suicide sent a box of photos that somebody left in a storage room from 1921, after the massacre, 1921 and 22, because he showed them to me, of black folks standing in front of their homes after the massacre in fur coats with a flag in front of their porch, and the house is just destroyed in the background, but it's full of building materials. And them saying, we back, and we getting ready to rebuild.
Right on. Okay.
And it's just a box full of photos like that. You're like, man, that's the kind of stuff that our kids need to see, that our elders need to see, that everybody need to see. That America need to see.
Mm-hmm.
You ain't seen resilience like the resilience we got.
Mm-hmm. Like you said, you don't. You know, you're left with the impression. You're left with the impression until I heard you and I seen it for myself in Tulsa last weekend. You're left with the impression after the devastation for those who could get out. They got out for those, and also too, we got to understand this. Those tents. Set up those 10 cities. Some of those people stayed in those 10 cities over a year or even more, didn't they?
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
But you got to understand that they rebuilt. They rebuilt after that.
Yeah.
It's just as good and just as beautiful as it was when it was destroyed. So you see those photos of that, but you don't see the photos of when they rebuilt. You don't see
That's
the photos
right.
of those businesses once again and the brothers and sisters doing and thriving amongst themselves. You don't see that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I tell my Christian friends when they do tours, you know, churches and stuff, and I say, listen, the same trick is getting played on you. Just imagine. Everybody focusing on the cross, ain't nobody focused on the resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? What's more valuable?
Right.
The fact that he died or the fact that he came back. Mm-hmm. When we talk about Greenwood, that's what we're talking about. What's right. more valuable? The fact that it was killed or the fact that it was resurrected?
Yeah.
Right? That's what they don't want you to know, because then you can destroy the resilience of a people.
Right.
Like, there is no comeback.
Right.
There is no, once you get destroyed, there is no comeback. That's why we kill off your heroes. That's mm-hmm. why we kill off, we assassinate your people, because we don't want you to think there's a comeback.
Right. Let me,
right? We get you in this isolated individualism, individualistic mindset mm-hmm. where you no longer think like those people who built Greenwood.
Right. Brother Jay, you got a last comment? We're closing out.
Yeah, okay. I was just wondering, in your research, how many communities were able to rebuild? And to the present, the people in that area, do they today understand the evil of them white folks that surround them, or are they just passive in their existence with them?
That's a very good question. It's very typical of what happens when people experience post-traumatic slave syndrome on top of post-traumatic stress syndrome. It's very on a collective level. Right, because you're talking about a people who experience mass trauma collectively, not individually, collectively. So what happens when people experience collective trauma? They internalize the trauma mm-hmm. if they get beat down enough. So you destroy Greenwood in 1921. Then you come back after the Renaissance of the 1950s, and you create a city plan, a 40-year plan in 1954 that says never again. What? How do we prevent this? Right? So the plan is already in place in 54 to build a highway through a community that is not blighted, that is not suffering because of integration. Right? Now you subject them to urban removal. All right? Another attempt at putting you through collective trauma. Then that generation that follows becomes the benefactors of integration, financial integration. Another trauma. Now you have people who make the last ditch effort and say, okay, now let's go to the federal government and let's seek restitution. Just for them to say, sorry, but the statute of limitations has run out. And all your elected officials have asked for immunity in the city from any culpability after the Supreme Court's decision. Now, all of those people who open their hearts and minds up to disclose to America what had been done to them, the wounds, right? It's like talking to somebody who experienced chattel slavery to tell you everything they remember and open up all the traumatic spaces in their mind. Mm-hmm. But you got a whole collective group of people who have done that. Mm-hmm. The beatdown, the emotional beatdown that collective community experiences is unimaginable. So when you come to Tulsa, that's why we tell people Tulsa is not going to ever be a city that is successful, a phenomenal city. I don't care how much oil and gas you have in the city. It will never look like Houston. It will never look like any other city that is developed, because the ancestors will never allow it. They will never allow it. And that's why you can't even kill a black man in Tulsa or woman without them referencing 1921. When Terrence Crutcher happened, why do you think they went and got that woman real quick and put her in jail? Because they knew these people have experienced collective trauma. They will burn this city down because they're still in pain.
That's right.
We no longer have the resources. We no longer have the things that we had because we fell for the okey-doke. We fell for the trick that everybody's falling for in black communities, right, when we start thinking about solutions. Everybody say, you got people who say, oh, we need to establish our own businesses and gain our own wealth and da-da-da-da. Yeah, but what's a wealthy person that's ignorant of their culture and they understand of their identity and who they are?
That's right. Thank
That's
you.
A slave with money.
That's right. I
say. All right. Well, we need education. Yeah, but what's the educated food? The miseducation of the Negro, right? So every solution you try to come up with, we're the only people that ever own property, right? So we think about, we have to put all those things in consideration because Greenwood broke every stereotype.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Every stereotype.
Go ahead, Jay. Go ahead, Jay.
Okay. You see?
All right, Jay's off, but he just wanted to say for you that, you know, for you to continue to do what you're doing. And I said the same thing. I was very honored to meet you. Happy
absolutely.
To be there.
Same
very,
here.
Very, very happy to be there to see the Greenwood Center and what was going on there. Also to the from the Greenwood Cultural Center to the Greenwood Leadership Academy, the school.
Yes, wonderful school.
Yes, it is. Brother Greg Robinson, you have those children who are
right.
who live it. Not only are they taught, they live it because in that school there's the streets there's Greenwood, there's Archer,
that's
there's
right.
Pine,
that's
you
right.
know, there's the railroad tracks, all of that. So they're taught that mm-hmm. history, and it ain't watered down. Right. It is what it
no,
is.
No, not at all.
You know? I want to thank Senator Kevin Matthews, a fellow firefighter, because
yes.
he came to our conference, our leadership, our training conference that we have every year in New Orleans, and he mentioned he would like for us to come to Tulsa. In fact, he was in Oklahoma City when we were in Oklahoma City last year in October and extended me and us that invitation. And so what that's about is they want to get professional, American African professional organizations to come to Tulsa next year within a 100-day span. Because for us, our training program is the beginning of June. So it might be problematic for us to come, you know, May 31st, June 1st, when the actual dates are happening. Although I'm going to try to be there because I feel it's important. I want to be there and to commemorate that. You know, it's not a celebration, damn it. It's a commemoration.
Yeah.
It is something solemn. It is something deep and graspful. I also want to say to Dr. View, really impressed with Dr. View and look forward to, I'm trying to get him on this radio program, but I'd like to get you back on prior to the 31st and the 1st to talk about some of the activities that are going to happen. And, but also to, you know, I know that they put a lot of money. I know the Kaiser Foundation put a lot of money into what's happening in Tulsa. But the reality is that it's, you know, y'all did what y'all did, and it's documented, it's proven.
You're right.
And
right.
yet this country continues to disrespect us, denigrate us, demean us. There is no respect for African life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reality.
That's right.
But it's always that
that's
fight.
Right.
And there's always that fight. And I appreciate you, brother, for the continuing to hold up that mirror, to continue to speak these special truths.
Brother, the pleasure is mine. I appreciate your work and your effort and everything that you're doing there. I was, you know, when you said your name on the tour, I knew right away I was a good couple.
That's right, brother.
Yeah, so I'm really grateful.
Me too.
Really grateful.
Well, let's stay in touch, dear brother. And let's continue to communicate and whatever I can do to promote anything that's happening because my program is internet radio. I have listeners from all over. I got listeners in the UK, in the Caribbean, and so forth. Sister in Africa, in Botswana. So, brother, you have a blessed and wonderful day.
You do the same. You do the same.
All
Take
right.
care.
Well, here's
Odabo.
Here's my ending. Listen to my ending. We end this program like we end all of our programs with the words of Stephen Biko. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind. Not just the MIND, but the MINE, because under the feet of African people lies all of the resources that everybody wants, think they can't do without, and sure in hell don't want to pay for. Brothers and sisters, it's been a pleasure. It's been an honor to have Chief Ogumuwale on my program from Tulsa, Oklahoma and the Black Wall Street. Brothers and sisters, you have a great weekend. Shem Hotep means go in peace. Esante Sana means thank you. Bibi Fahodia. Bibi Fahodia means our victorious destiny. Brothers and sisters, we will be victorious. Have a blessed and wonderful weekend. Brother Chief, thank you very much. Peace to you.
Thank you.